More gunshots exploded out of the darkness ahead of them, and he swore silently as he heard screams from farther out on the river. He had no idea who was behind those shots or what in God's name anyone was doing out here on the river bank in the middle of nowhere an hour before dawn. What mattered was that the boats on the open river were far more visible than the men hiding in the impenetrable shadows under the willows, alders, and conewood along the bank. "Stay low," he commanded, pitching his voice as low as possible. "Keep in the water as long as you can, and follow me." Wading through ice-cold, neck-deep water would have been a slow, exhausting process, even without the current. They couldn't possibly move as quickly as he wanted to, and with gunshots continuing to crack from the darkness, it seemed to be taking even longer. Then someone in one of the boats managed to begin returning fire, which added the delightful possibility of being shot in the back by their own people. The good news, for Aplin Armach and his people at least, was that there seemed to be at least three times as many bullets headed out from the bank at the other boats and away from them. He felt the river bottom underfoot smoothing as it shallowed, more sand mixed among the rocks and gravel, and breathed a silent prayer of thanks as the footing improved. He had picked his destination more by instinct than by anything resembling deliberate thought. But that instinct had served him well, he realized. He and his boat crew were coming up on the riverside of a huge fallen conewood trunk that screened them completely from anyone on shore. He stopped for a moment, looking around, making sure the rest of his people were with him. There were only 10 of them, and he bared his teeth while the muskets continued to fire out of the darkness. He saw the blink-lizard glow of slow matches scattered under the trees, and his eyes narrowed. "Matchlocks, boys," he told them in a low voice. "Nice little lights to help us find the bastards, and it sounds like they're loading loose powder. They're going to be slow. Get in close and rip their guts out. Got it?" A chorus of growls answered him, and he nodded sharply. "And while you're at it, howl like you're all damned marines," he said with a savage grin. "Now, after me, lads!" His boat crew exploded out of the water, vaulting over the conewood trunk with naked steel in hand. Aplin Armach carried his sword in his right hand and a wicked, spike-backed boarding tomahawk in his left, and the high, baying war cry of the Imperial Marines came with him. It sounded as if there were at least 50 of them, he thought wildly, and then a figure loomed up in front of him. A cavalryman, he thought, taking in the dimly seen helmet, but armed with a matchlock. That meant a dragoon, not a lancer or a hussar, probably, and Delphiracan dragoons didn't have breastplates, and that meant Carisian cutlasses had chisel points, as well adapted to thrusting as to slashing, and Aplin Armach felt the jerking quiver of someone else's muscles transmitted up the blade as he drove a foot of steel into the man's chest. The dragoon shrieked, clutching at the impaling blade, but Aplin Armach kicked him away and went charging past him, screaming like a madman just like the rest of his boat crew. The dragoons, who'd been waiting in ambush, reared up from their firing positions, turning towards the demons who had suddenly materialized in their midst, and shocked astonishment turned almost instantly into panic. It was impossible for either side to know how many enemies it actually faced, and surprise and fear didn't lend themselves well to making accurate estimates. Aplin Armach hacked down another opponent. A third man came at him desperately, matchlock clubbed, completely forgetting the sword at his own side in his panic. The lieutenant ducked under the musket, but the dragoon was on the wrong side for his cutlass. The tomahawk lashed out, coming up from below, driving its sharpened, spur-like hook up through the man's jaw and into the roof of his mouth. The Delphirakan scream chopped off in a hot spray of blood, and Aplin Armach lost his grip on the suddenly slippery tomahawk as the body fell. another dragoon loomed up. This one, an officer who'd remembered his sword. It was several inches longer than Aplin Armagh's cutlass, but the lieutenant had served under Sir Duncan Yearley. That meant every midshipman and ensign spent a solid hour at sword drill every single day, and the instincts Sylvester Ragley had helped pound into Aplin Armagh's muscle memory took over. He twisted away from the Delphiracan's frantic, clumsy thrust, and his left hand lashed out, capturing the wrist of the dragoon's sword arm. The Delphiracan was bigger, taller, and broader-shouldered than Aplin Armagh, but the lieutenant's wiry strength and the advantage of surprise were enough to shove the other man's arm almost straight up as they slammed together, chest to chest, at which point Aplin Armagh's cutlass drove into his belly with all the elegance of a meat axe. The officer went down with a bubbling scream, and suddenly there was no more fighting. Instead, there were only moans, sobs, and in the distance, the thud and thunder of galloping hooves disappearing into the darkness. "Anybody with a prisoner, hang on to him!" Aplin Armagh barked, and then turned back to the river. "That's the best I can do, sir," Lywis Tabor said. The healer's mate looked drawn and weary, and well he should. The ambush had cost the boat party heavily, with 5 dead and twice that many wounded. Now he stood up, rubbing his back, and looked glumly down at Lieutenant Fergus Gawain, who lay unconscious on the rough pad made of captured Delphiracan saddle blankets. "How soon is he going to wake up?" Aplin Armagh asked. He felt as tired as the healer's mate looked, but he couldn't afford to admit it. "Dunno, sir," Tabor said honestly. "Head wound like that, he may never wake up. Or he could come to in the next 10 minutes. If you want me to guess, probably not for a day or two. And I don't know if his wits are going to be wandering when he does come to or not." "I see." Aplin Armagh gazed down at the lieutenant for several moments, then patted the healer's mate on the shoulder. "Thank you," he said sincerely, "and not just for the prognosis. The lads are lucky they had you along." "Did what I could, sir," Tabor replied in an exhausted voice. "But I'd be lying if I said I was happy about them. Got at least 4 we need to get to a proper healer fast as we can, or we'll lose them, sure as Shan Wei." "Understood." Aplin Armagh patted him on the shoulder again, then walked to the river bank and stared out across the cold, clear water. Lieutenant Gawain, HMS Victorious First Lieutenant, was in command of the entire operation. But now he was unconscious indefinitely, and Lieutenant Brynden Margail, the senior marine, was dead, which left Lieutenant Aplin Armagh, all 16 years old of him, in command, and the next best thing to 200 miles from the nearest senior officer. At least they'd taken 3 of the dragoons alive, and the Delphiracans had been so shocked by the abrupt reversal of their ambush that their tongues had wagged freely. It was also possible the sight of Stewart Malik contemplatively sharpening a knife as he smiled evilly in their direction might have had some bearing on their loquaciousness, of course. Aplin Armagh had kept them separated from one another to deprive them of any opportunity to coordinate their stories. Yet all 3 of them had told basically the same tale. Word of the attack on Sarmath had spread even faster than Admiral Yearley's plan had allowed for. Worse, some idiot upriver from the port had actually believed the boat expedition's warnings that the horrible Carisian heretics were sending an entire invasion fleet up the miserable Sarm River. Aplin Armagh couldn't understand how anybody with the sense to pour piss out of a boot, to borrow one of Malik's favourite phrases, could have credited that story. But according to all 3 of their prisoners, one of Duke of Charles Bailiffs had actually believed the Carisians were burning both banks of the river as they advanced deep into the heart of Delphirac. He had sounded the alarm and sent out parties of dragoons to scout for the invaders. The one good aspect of the entire comic opera farce was that the dragoons in question were militiamen, not regulars. The bad news was that this particular lot of them had spotted the Carisian boats the previous evening and shadowed them from shore. Working against the current, the boats were actually slower than the horsemen, which was how the Delphiracans had been able to get into position for the ambush. And an unknown number of them had gotten away. By now, they had to be raising the alarm, and Aplin Armach doubted the number of Carisian invaders was going to decline when they started explaining how they'd gotten their asses kicked. Which meant every man the Delphiracans could scrape up would be hunting for his people by late afternoon. So what did he do? If there were more dragoons available, it wouldn't be hard for them to repeat this bunch's tactics. And even if there weren't, the word had to be going out by semaphore, if it was available, and by runner and courier, if the semaphore wasn't available, even as he stood here. He knew how important this mission was, but if he continued, the odds were overwhelming that he'd simply lead his own pursuers straight to the people he was supposed to be rescuing. And that didn't even consider those badly wounded men Tabor had mentioned. He looked out at the slowly flowing water and tried to think. 4. Sunthorn Mountains and Royal Palace, City of Talkara, Kingdom of Delphirak. Lazy wings of snow drifted almost silently on the wind, sighing among the peaks of the Sunthorn Mountains 90-odd miles northwest of the city of Talkara. The temperature hovered at a brisk 6 degrees below zero on the old Fahrenheit scale, and the stars showing through the cloud rifts overhead were huge and bright and icy. Technically it was spring south of the equator, but at these elevations that meant very little, especially in the small, still hours of the morning, just after Langhorne's watch. The single Imperial Carisian guardsman sat in a lotus position atop an ice-crusted boulder. He'd been sitting there for 3 days now, ever since his conversation with Baron Corris, and there was snow drifted on his hair, and on his skin, for that matter, but he seemed unaware of it. Because he was unaware of it. He'd allowed his body temperature to drop to that of the air about him, and after he'd caught up on some of the snark reports he'd been unable to give proper attention to when they first came in, and spent a day or so contemplating future possibilities, he had actually put himself on standby and taken the equivalent of a lengthy nap. It wasn't as if anyone was going to be wandering around 4,000 feet above the permanent snowline to stumble across him while he was asleep, and it would probably make Caleb happy. And if it didn't, at least it would offer him a handy bit of ammunition to toss back at the Emperor the next time Caleb decided to lecture him about the need for downtime. It wasn't often Merlin Athroyes had the opportunity to simply sit and think, which made him value those rare chances even more when one of them came along. For the most part, he was far too visible. Aside from those retreats to meditate, which had become a more frequent part of his life of late, for something like this. If Sajin Merlin dropped out of sight, even briefly, people started wondering where he was and what he was up to, and, as a general rule, he tried very hard to avoid having people wonder about things like that. In this instance, however, it was going to be necessary to explain how Captain Athroyes had gotten to the city of Talkara, or, to be more accurate, it was going to be necessary to allow time for him to have made the trip. Everyone knew Sajin's moved in mysterious ways and at speeds few other mortals could match, so the exact details of his travel arrangements could be glossed over. But it still took them at least some time to make a journey of over 6,000 miles, which was why he had left Tellisburg five days earlier. He'd spent most of that time in Nemu's cave, going over reports, discussing the events racing towards a violent confrontation in the Republic of Sidamark with the rest of the Inner Circle, refining the propaganda Owl's remotes were distributing across all three continents, catching up on some reading, and working with Owl on a couple of private projects he'd been unable to give proper attention before. In particular, he and the AI had the Class 2 VR unit almost up and running. Owl still didn't have the specifications he needed to build another Pika, and Merlin was no more enthusiastic than he had been about letting the computer take apart his own cybernetic housing to find out how it worked. But at least if he had to, he now had a refuge for his and Nemo's memories and personality. A Class 2 VR wasn't as big and capable as the massive virtual reality computers the Terran Federation had used as homes for electronic iterations of their top R&D military analysts and pure researchers. It simply didn't have the memory and the processing power to maintain 2 or 3 dozen fully aware personalities in detailed virtual environments, indistinguishable, from the inside, from reality. A Class 2 could handle no more than 3 or, at the outside, 4 virtual personalities if it was going to give the VPs a fully developed world in which to live. There'd be plenty of room for Nemo Merlin, though. If worse came to worst, he could set up housekeeping in there even if Sajin Merlin became totally inoperable, and at least one other possible use had occurred to him, although he still wasn't at all certain that one was going to work out. In addition, he had decided it was time to take advantage of Commander Mandrain's work with his breech-loading rifle and the percussion caps he had developed for it. And he and Owl had used some of the free time to redesign his own sidearms. Those were going to come as a nasty surprise to someone, possibly sometime soon, he thought, and they wouldn't violate a single clause of the prescriptions. Father Pater had already made that abundantly clear, although none of the Empire's gunsmiths had yet come up with the design he and Owl had built. The truth was, though, that as much as he'd enjoyed having time to tinker and putter, he'd gotten bored. Unfortunately, he'd had no choice but to go on marking time for at least another 5 days or two if he didn't want to raise all sorts of eyebrows about the truly miraculous, not simply mysterious, speed with which Sajin Merlin could cover distances of over 6,000 or 7,000 miles. And that was why he'd landed here in the mountains after Zemon's chat with Corus, sent the recon skimmer back to Owl, ordered his nannies to regrow Sajin Merlin's hair, and then gone to standby mode for 50 minutes of every hour. Of course, even with that, if anyone ever started adding up times, they were bound to come to the conclusion that Sajins must know some magic spell to give them command of wind and wave. In theory, he had sailed from the earldom of West Harding, the island of Kharis' westernmost headland, rather than Tellisburg, which had at least reduced the length of his supposed voyage to the Desnarian Empire's crowned lands from over 10,000 miles to only 5,700. He'd actually turned up in West Harding, publicly and noisily, borrowed a 40-foot single-masted schooner, and put to sea in order to make sure everyone knew how he'd gotten where he was going in the fullness of time. That schooner, unfortunately, was now on the bottom of the Parker Sea. He regretted that. It had been a sweet little craft, and Nemo had always loved single-handing her sloop back on old Terra whenever she'd had the chance. In fact, he was increasingly irked with himself for having abandoned the schooner as quickly as he had. With so much time to kill, he might as well have spent some of it doing something he had always enjoyed so much before. "You need a vacation," he told himself. Well, to be fair, I guess you needed a vacation. You'd really have to call the last month or so something like a vacation after all, but you're just too damn contrary to actually take time off, aren't you? Always have to be doing something. Everything depends on you, he snorted mentally. You need Charlie or Caleb closer to hand to kick you in the butt when you get too full of your own importance. It was amazing how comforting it was to be able to think that. The loss of so many colleagues left a special aching wound at the centre of the theoretically immortal Sajin's heart. Yet the inner circle had survived, even continued to grow. Best of all, he wasn't indispensable any longer, and that was a greater relief than he'd ever imagined it might be. If something happened to him, the others would still have access to Owl and the technology hidden away in Nemu's cave. Not that he planned on anything happening to him, of course. It was just... "Excuse me, Lieutenant Commander Alban." Merlin twitched internally, although his physical body never moved as Owl's voice invaded his thoughts. "Yes?" "The sensor net deployed to cover Talkaira has reported a situation which programming parameters require me to call to your attention."
"What sort of situation?" "No, scratch that. I assume you have the raw take from the sensors for me, yes?"
"Affirmative, Lieutenant Commander Alban." "Then I suppose you'd better show it to me." "Tobis." Tobis Raymer looked up from the dagger edge he'd been carefully honing, and cocked an eyebrow at the man who had just poked his head into his Spartan little bedchamber. Corporal Zach Maurice was one of his small guard force's non-coms. Normally a calm, almost phlegmatic sort, he looked more than a little anxious at the moment.
"What is it, Zachy?"
"There's something going on," Murray said. "You know Zach Taylor?"
"Sure,"
Rayman nodded. Taylor was one of King Zaim's guardsmen. He was also a drinking buddy of Murray's, and Rayman and Duke Corris had encouraged the corporal to pursue the friendship.
"What about him?"
"He says there's been a lot of going back and forth between Colonel Sandal's office and Father Geisbert's office since lunchtime. A lot, Tobis." Ramirez's face stiffened. Father Geisberg van Dijk was a Schulerite upper priest attached to Bishop Mitchell's office in Talkaira.
"What kind of back and forth?" Ramirez asked.
"Dunno. He said it was Brother Baldwin mostly, though, and van Dijk came back to the castle with him about an hour ago." Better and better, Ramirez thought. Baldwin Gamlin was attached to the king's household, technically as a secretary, although there was precious little evidence King Zaim's had requested his services. "Did Taylor have any idea what it was about?" he asked.
"If he did, he wasn't telling me." Murray's looked even more concerned.
"He's somebody to hoist a few beers with, Tobis, not my blood brother. He may know, or suspect, a lot he's not telling me. On the other hand, at least he dropped some warning on me."
Rayman nodded, although he had to wonder if Taylor's decision to warn Maurice had really been his own.
Raymer could think of a couple of scenarios in which a particularly devious Schulerite, and they were all devious, sneaky, underhanded bastards, might arrange to have a warning passed in order to manipulate someone he suspected into incriminating himself.
"Thanks, Zachy," he said now, standing and sliding the dagger into its belt sheath. "Pass the word to the rest of the lads. No one makes any moves, no one does anything to suggest we're worried, but check your equipment and be sure you keep it handy. I want them ready to move fast and hard if we have to. Got it?"
"Got it." Maurice nodded and disappeared, and Raymer walked down a short hallway, up a half flight of stairs, and knocked on another door.
"Yes,"
a voice responded. "Could I have a minute of your time, my lord?"
"I don't know, Iris,"
Philip Asgood said, looking out the turret window into the darkness.
"I can't think of any good reason for van Dijk to be talking to Colonel Sandal, or not any reason that would be good for us, anyway."
"Can we go ahead and run now?" Iris asked, watching his back, seeing the tension in his shoulders.
"Maybe. But we weren't supposed to run for another 2 days, and we don't even know for sure what's happening. Making a break for it now might be the worst thing we could do."
The frustration in his voice was evident, and he turned to her with a sour expression.
"I'm not used to having things like this sneak up on me."
"I know you're not," Iris said with a lopsided smile, "and I count on it not happening,
But you're only human, Philip, and the truth is...
And the truth is... A much deeper voice neither of them had ever heard before said calmly. That everyone makes mistakes occasionally. Even me.
Iris and Corris whipped back around to the window just as a tall man with blue eyes, fierce mustachios, and a dagger beard swung lightly over the windowsill and into the room. The fact that they were three stories up and that the wall fell sheer from the window would have made that astonishing enough. But to make bad worse, the stranger wore the livery of the Corisian Imperial Guard in the middle of the capital of the Kingdom of Delphirac. The Earl and the Princess gaped at the apparition, and he bowed gracefully.
"Please excuse my unceremonious arrival," he said, straightening from the bow and stroking his moustache. "Captain Merlin Athroy's at your service."
"But how?" The imperturbability of even a Philip Osgood had its limits, and the Duke of Corris couldn't seem to get the question finished. He only stared at the newcomer, and Merlin chuckled. Iris Dakin was made of sterner stuff, though.
"Captain Athroy's," she acknowledged, bending her head in a gracious nod. "I won't say the Empire of Caris is especially near and dear to my heart, but at this moment I'm most happy to see you."
"Thank you, Your Highness." He bowed more deeply.
"And please accept their Majesty's greetings. They look forward to seeing you safely out of Delphirac."
"And into Telesburg, of course," she riposted in a slightly barbed tone.
"Well, of course, Your Highness. But I'm trying not to be tacky," Merlin murmured with a slight smile, and Iris' lips quivered for just a moment. Then she cleared her throat.
"It would appear you've arrived at an opportune moment, Sajin Merlin," she said then.
"Of course, we don't know why it's an opportune moment or how you've managed to arrive at it, now do we?"
"In answer to the second half of your question, Your Highness, everyone insists on calling me a Sajin, so it's only reasonable I should act like one on occasion, including arriving at opportune moments. If I recall my fairy tales correctly, Sajin Cody did a lot of that sort of thing." He smiled more broadly, but then his expression sobered. "And in answer to the question you and Duke Corris were discussing when I arrived, I hope you don't mind that I spent a moment or two listening outside your window before I intruded. It turns out Master Sea Blanket wasn't the only spy planted on you by the Inquisition, after all."
"He wasn't?"
Corris came back to life, his eyes narrowing. He sounded more than a little affronted by Merlin's explanation, and Merlin smiled at him.
"It's not really your fault, my lord," he said. "As you may know from your discussions with my friend Abraham, we Sajins have our own means of gathering intelligence. That's how I discovered Bishop Mitchell had decided to insert one of his own agents into King Zaim's household to keep an eye on you. He wasn't instructed to, and his agent reports only to him, not to Reynal or Clintan, but I'm afraid he's come to the conclusion that you're, well, up to something. He doesn't know what, but he's decided it's probably something you shouldn't be doing. So he sent Father Gaispert to order Colonel Sandal to take your own guardsmen into custody and replace them with members of King Zaim's guard, under Father Gaispert's direct command. Just for your own safety, of course."
"And the king?" Iris asked, gazing at Merlin intently. "Is he party to all this?"
"No, and so far as I'm aware, neither is Baron Lakeland or Sir Clement," Merlin told her. "On the other hand, none of them will attempt to overrule Bishop Mitchell, Your Highness. And, to be honest, you can't really blame them, can you?"
"My heart certainly can, Sajin Merlin," she said tartly, but then she shook her head. "My head, unfortunately, can't. Not knowing what that butcher Clintan would do to anyone who helped her slip out of his clutches."
"Slip out of his clutches alive, Your Highness," Merlin corrected gently.
"Correction accepted, Sajin Merlin. "How much time do we have before Sandal moves?" Corus demanded.
"None," Merlin replied calmly.
"There are 40 royal guardsmen on their way right now, along with half a dozen inquisitors, and their instructions are to use whatever force is necessary to make sure none of you go anywhere."
40?
Corus exclaimed in dismay.
"All we have to do is get out of the castle, reach the stable where you've had those horses waiting for a week, and then ride for the rendezvous."
Merlin replied with a shrug, as if he were discussing a simple picnic outing.
"Past 40 royal guardsmen?"
"And the inquisitors, my lord," Merlin reminded him. The Earl glared at him and the Sajin shrugged.
"Sergeant Raymere has his people ready, my lord," he pointed out, "and they're all good, solid men. They'll take care of 20 or 25 of Zaim's armsmen if they have to, I'm sure."
"And the other 20 armsmen? And the half dozen inquisitors?"
Corus inquired, more than a bit acidly.
"Ah, them,"
Merlin shrugged again.
"Well, for them, my lord, you have me."
7. Royal Palace, City of Talkaira, Kingdom of Delphirag.
"Father, are you sure this is something we want to do?"
Colonel Freyman Sandal asked.
"Are you questioning the Inquisition, my son?"
Father Gaispert van Dijk asked in a gentle, silky tone.
"Never, father," Sandal replied as calmly as he could. "I simply don't have any orders from His Majesty, and it would only take an hour or so to send a messenger after him."
"My orders are from Bishop Mitchell," van Dijk pointed out. "And were His Majesty here, I'm sure he would remind you, secular forces are required to assist Mother Church's intendant when he calls upon them."
Sandal did his best not to glare at the smiling Shularite. He'd met priests like Van Dijk before, more often than he might have wished, and he knew exactly how Van Dijk's report to his own superiors would be written if Sandal didn't do exactly what he wanted. Yet the colonel's oaths hadn't been sworn to the Inquisition. They'd been sworn to King Zaim's of Delphirag, and he wasn't at all certain the king would have approved of the notion of seizing his own relatives and handing them over to the Inquisition for their own safety, especially when he'd been ordered to do the seizing by force, and extra especially when Van Dijk had told him orally that this mission was important enough to risk endangering Princess Iris or Prince Davin's lives, and declined to include that in his written instructions. The colonel was a simple soldier, disinterested in politics and a loyal son of Mother Church, but he wasn't stupid, and he had served as the second-in-command of King Zaim's guard for almost 7 years. Whether he had wanted to or not, he'd developed political feelers over those years, and every one of them quivered with warning now. The waters around him had suddenly become deep and murky, and he found himself much more seriously considering a ridiculous suspicion which had crossed his mind some time ago when he pondered who might have assassinated Prince Hector if it hadn't been Caleb Armagh. "Of course I realize His Majesty's Guard is obligated to assist Mother Church in time of need, father," he said with all the dignity he could summon up. "I'm sure you can understand that, as King Zaim's man. I'd really prefer to get his instructions as well, however."
"If there were time for that, I would have no objections at all," Van Dijk assured him. "Unfortunately, I don't believe there is time. And in that regard, Colonel, I'm afraid I have to point out that we're wasting time discussing this."
He glanced pointedly out Sandal's office window at the tower in which the Coruscantian exiles were housed, and the colonel's jaw tightened. There were limits to what he could ignore, however, and he gave the Inquisitor a jerky nod.
"Point taken, father," he said, then raised his voice. "Captain Margale."
"Sir?"
A tall but stocky officer replied, opening the office door and stepping through it.
"Get them ready, Bert," Sandal said.
"Yes, sir."
Miguel saluted and disappeared, and Sandal heard him giving orders in a loud, clear voice. Miguel was a good man, but he was a bit too prone, in Sandal's opinion, to take a churchman's word at face value. If the Inquisition said Princess Iris and Prince Davin were in danger from their own retainers, then Miguel was perfectly prepared to kill as many of those retainers as necessary to rescue them. He obviously wasn't going to lose one bit of sleep over his orders either, unlike Sandal. The colonel had recognized the kind of man Tobias Raymair was the moment he had laid eyes on him, and he knew that kind of man would die in defense of his prince or princess. The thought that he might somehow threaten them was ludicrous. But no one was interested in Freyman Sandal's opinion, except perhaps for his liege lord, who he wasn't going to be allowed to ask about it. "I'm sorry, Your Majesty," he thought now, rising heavily and reaching for his own sword belt. "I knew I should have drowned that little weasel, Brother Baldwin, months ago when I realized why Jessup planted him on you. Secretary! Ha!" Unfortunately, he hadn't, and he buckled the sword belt, settled it in place, and strode slowly and deliberately out of his office. "The good news is that over half the regular palace guard detachment is off with the king and queen tonight," Tobias Raymair said to the tall, blue-eyed Carisian guardsman. Right offhand, Raymair couldn't think of anything he'd ever done that felt stranger than taking orders from a Carisian when it was the Carisian Empire which had conquered his own homeland. And the man had to be crazy as a Ha-Chong serf drunk on that incredibly vile rice-based whiskey they distilled to go wandering around the middle of the kingdom of Delphirac in Carisian livery. He had heard about the Farad massacre and why most Delphiracans believed it had happened, hadn't he? On the other hand, Sajin Merlin was obviously accustomed to being obeyed. And crazy or not, something about him, something that spoke to Raymare's well-honed non-com's instincts, made Raymair grateful he was here. Hell, some of the best combat officers I've ever known were bug-ass crazy, come to that, he reflected. Not necessarily the safest ones to serve under, maybe, but the kind who always seem to get the job done somehow. And that's what it's all about tonight, isn't it? The job. He glanced over his shoulder at the tall, slender young woman with her arm around her brother's shoulders, her own expression calm and confident, because that was what the boy needed her to be. Then he looked back at the Carisian Imperial Guardsman and saw those blue eyes watching him. "Don't worry, Sergeant," Merlin said quietly, voice pitched for only Raymare's ears, and his expression was far more sober than it had been. "I know it's complicated, but I give you my word. You can't possibly want those two to reach safety more than I do. And between us, that's exactly where we're going to get them." "If you say so, Captain." "I do say so," Merlin replied, resting one hand lightly on the sergeant's shoulder for a moment. "And you remind me of another sergeant I met a couple of years ago. A fellow by the name of C. Hamper. I think you'll like him when you meet him. And do me a favor." "Favor?" Raymair asked, just a bit suspiciously. "Stay alive and in one piece," Merlin said very seriously. "Prince Davin and Princess Iris need you. Unless I'm mistaken, she needs you more than he does at the moment, as a matter of fact, and I think she's already lost enough people she needed, don't you?" Raymair stared at him for a moment, then nodded slowly, his expression one of wonderment. "Aye," he said after a moment. "Aye, that she has. Then let's not make any more holes in her life." The hand on Raymair's shoulder tightened, and then the reckless, confident grin reappeared under the waxed mustachios. "Now, you were saying about the opposition?" "So I was, sir." Raymair gave himself another shake. "There's no more than half the usual detachment here tonight.
The colonel could call up reinforcements from the local militia, and there's a full regiment of militia dragoons in Talcara. Take a while to get them routed out of bed and pulled away from their dinners, though. And to be honest, I don't see any reason he'd be thinking he needed 'em come to that. The sergeant shrugged. These are good lads I've got here, but there's only a dozen of 'em when all's said. Even with only half the detachment, he's four times that many. Understood. Merlin's expression turned serious again. You do realize that the instant they see me, you're all going to be guilty of treason and consorting with heretics, in both Mother Church and King Zaim's eyes.
Thought had crossed my mind, Raymer replied with sour irony. Don't suppose I could convince you to change out of that armor of yours.
Sergeant, it's not going to make one bit of difference in the long run, Merlin chuckled. The moment Grand Inquisitor Zaspar discovers Iris and Davin have slipped through his fingers alive, we're all dead men if he ever gets his hands on us. That being the case, I prefer to fight in my own colours. And if seeing you in them causes Colonel Sandal's lads to come at us harder, my own lads are going to find any bridges burned behind them, Raymer said. A point which had occurred to me, Merlin acknowledged. Of course, that's another way of saying it's going to get them focused on staying alive and keep them there, isn't it?
Sounds better that way anyhow, Raymer said, then laughed. And, truth to tell, we've burned our bridges already.
That's fortunate, Merlin told him, raising his hand and cocking it to one side. Because unless I'm mistaken, Colonel Sandal's on his way right now. Freyman Sandal walked across the paved courtyard with a grim, determined stride. Three squads of guardsmen followed him, and he sensed the men's confusion. They had no idea why they'd just been ordered to arrest and, if necessary, kill men they'd been drinking beer with only that afternoon. The presence of half a dozen Shularites, including Baldwin Gamlin, who'd been one of King Zaim's secretaries for almost a year, discouraged any speculation on their part, however. And with those damned inquisitors watching, there was no doubt in Sandal's mind his men would do whatever they were ordered to do.
God, I hope Raymer and Corus are smart enough to surrender for the kid's sake, he thought. Yet even as he told himself that, another thought ran deeper down, counterpointing it. Given what Zaspar Clintan was capable of, if he were one of the men in that tower and he believed the Inquisition had come for him, they'd take his weapons only out of his cold, dead hands. And the last thing he'd do before he died was cut both of Prince Hector's children's throats to keep them out of the Inquisition's hands as well.
Stop that, he told himself sternly. It's not doing a bit of good and it's not going to change a thing.
Wait here, he told Margail, and continued across the courtyard to the steep flight of steps leading up to the tower's open door. He climbed the steps heavily. A pair of lanterns burned at its top, one on either side of the massively timbered door set deep into the tower's ancient stonework, and he was acutely aware of the archer's slits in the wall above him. He allowed no sign of that awareness to cross his expression, however, as Rasko Mulligan, who would have been Sergeant Mulligan if Tobias Raymer had dared to be open about the nature of the footmen and servants he had assembled around Iris and Davin Dakin, met him in the doorway.
"Evening, Colonel," Mulligan said calmly, glancing past him at the block of guardsmen in the courtyard.
"Can I help you, sir?"
"I need to speak to Duke Corus, Rasko," Sandal said.
"Afraid he's already turned in for the evening, sir," Mulligan smiled slightly. "Said something about not feeling too well."
"Then I'm afraid you're going to have to go up and get him up," Sandal said flatly, and looked Mulligan straight in the eye.
"It's official, Rasko, and I'm under orders.
Let's not make this any messier than it has to be."
"Messy, sir?"
Mulligan had many virtues. Thespian talent was not among them, and his lack of surprise was all the confirmation Sandal needed that Tobias and his men had at least sensed what was coming. That was going to make things ugly, given their position inside the tower's thick walls. Nonetheless, just go get him, Rasko, the colonel said in that same flat voice. And you might ask Tobias to step out here too. I need to talk to both of them.
See what I can do, sir, Mulligan replied, and stepped back inside the tower.
Sandal was tempted to follow him, but he suppressed the temptation easily. He doubted Mulligan had been the only occupant of the guardroom just inside the doorway, and he wondered if it might not have been wiser to just go ahead and rush the place without warning anyone inside he was coming.
No, you were right the first time, he told himself. Too good a chance the girl or the boy'd get killed in the confusion, even if you got inside on the first rush. And if they really have figured out you're coming, trying to rush a tower like this would be a good way to get half your men killed at the outset. So,
his thoughts broke off in an abrupt mental hiccup as someone else stepped out of the tower door. Not Mulligan, and sure as hell not Duke Corris. The man in front of him was taller than either of them, a good 2 or 3 inches taller even than Captain Margale, with sapphire eyes, black hair, and a scarred cheek. Sandal had never seen him before in his life, which would have been cause enough for surprise in itself, but finding himself face to face with someone in the livery of the Corisian Imperial Guard hit him like a punch in the belly.
"I'm afraid Duke Corris and Sergeant Raymer are occupied," the impossible stranger said. "Perhaps I might be of assistance, Colonel."
Who?
Sandal realized he sounded entirely too much like a stupefied owl, and he gave himself a sharp, tooth-rattling jerk.
"Captain Merlin Athroyes, Corisian Imperial Guard, at your service."
The man bowed, apparently blissfully unaware of the insanity of what he had just said.
"And I'm afraid, Colonel, that Prince Davin and Princess Iris have requested asylum in Tellersburg. It seems..." Those blue eyes looked past the colonel and into the dumbstruck brown eyes of Father Gaispert. "Vicar Zaspar has ordered that they be killed, much as he did their father, and they'd prefer to avoid that outcome. Undutiful of them, I know, but..." His smile could have frozen Lake Erdan in midsummer. "I'm sure you can understand their viewpoint."
"That's ridiculous,"
Sandal managed, feeling his hand creep to the sword at his side.
"Oh, come now, Colonel," Athroyes chided gently. "You know I'm telling you the truth. Clintons decided murdering Davin may destabilize Coruscant again, especially if he can blame it on Karis again."
Those blue eyes were even colder than his smile, a fragment of Sandal's mind observed.
"Lies! Lies!"
Van Dijk shouted suddenly from behind Sandal.
"This man is an acknowledged heretic and blasphemer, an enemy of God himself. How can you even consider the possibility he might be telling the truth?"
"Ah, now, there's the problem, isn't it, Father Gaispert?"
Athroyes said, and the Schulerite stiffened at the revelation that the Corisian knew his name.
"And a bit of a problem for Father Zames and Father Arthur and Brother Baldwin and Brother Zilbert too, isn't it?"
the heretic continued, naming each of the inquisitors in turn.
"Because you know they are considering it, don't you, Father? Thanks to that butcher in Zion you serve, everyone's considering it, aren't they, Father?"
"Lies!"
Van Dijk screamed.
"Yield now, heretic, or die!"
"Let me see." Athroyes tilted his head to one side, eyes contemptuous. "Surrender and be tortured to death later for Clintan's amusement? Or die now, seeing how many of his inquisitors and their flunkies, I'm afraid, Colonel," he added, eyes flitting back to Sandal, "I can kill first. Let me see. Which one should I choose?"
"Heretic bastard!"
Van Dijk screamed,
Do your duty, Sandal. Seize him. Seize him and all the others as well, or answer to Mother Church.
Sandal half drew his sword, then froze as Athroes waved an index finger at him like a chiding tutor. The Carisian guardsman's sheer force of will seemed to freeze all of Sandal's men. It certainly froze the colonel himself. If you try to execute that order, or to seize Prince Davin or Princess Iris, or to prevent them in any way from leaving this castle of their own free will, colonel, a lot of people are going to die. There was no humor at all in Athroy's voice. Most of them will be yours. He looked very levelly into Sandal's eyes. I have no desire to kill any man simply because he has the misfortune to serve a corrupt and evil master, but the choice is yours. Stand aside, or try to take us. Live or die, Colonel. Make the choice.
He's insane, Iris Dakin whispered, watching from the third-floor window, listening to the conversation with Duke Corus' arm around her shoulders. My God, he's out of his mind.
Maybe he is, the Earl replied, shaking his head, but there was something very like admiration in his tone.
Maybe he is, but Langhorne, it feels good to hear someone take one of those sanctimonious pricks on in public.
Iris' head turned. She looked up at Corus' profile, and her eyes widened as she saw the fierce, triumphant grin on her guardian's face.
"You like him," she said almost accusingly. "Like him?" Corus cocked his head consideringly. "Maybe. I don't know about that, Iris, but by God, you've got to admire his style."
"That's bold talk for one man alone standing in front of 50," Sandal replied at last. "There are good men enough standing behind me," Athroes said evenly. "And you're standing in front of me. If you want to survive this night, Colonel, be somewhere else. Now."
Sandal stared at him, ice crawling through his veins, as he digested the total certitude in the Carisian's voice and remembered all the fantastic tales about Sajin Merlin. But the colonel was a veteran. He recognized tall tales and impossible legends when he heard them, and he was no coward. It was entirely possible Athroes might kill him, especially at such short range, but not even a Sajin could defeat 45 royal guardsmen plus the Inquisitors with them. And better to die cleanly fighting someone like Athroes than answer to the Inquisition if the prince or the princess get away, a small, still voice said, deep at his core.
I thank you for the warning, Captain Athroes, he heard his voice say. But I think not. He drew a deep breath. Take them.
Sandal's sword came out of its sheath. That, unfortunately, was the first and last thing that happened the way he had planned, because Merlin Athroy's hands moved. Philip Osgood, watching from the window above the tower door, hissed in disbelief. No one could move that quickly, no one. One instant the Sajin's hands were at his side, his shoulders relaxed, his eyes locked with Colonel Sandal's. The next instant, there was a pistol in each hand, as if they'd magically materialized there and not been drawn from the holsters at his side. And then they began to fire. It was hopeless, of course. One man with only 2 pistols against 50. Even if he was a crack shot who never missed, the most he could hope for would be to fell 4 of them before the others charged up the stairs and swarmed him under. But Merlin Athroes seemed unaware of that, and the blinding brilliance of a muzzle flash ripped holes in Corus' vision. The Sajin fired from the hip with both hands, and the measured crack, crack, crack of his fire pounded the ear like a hammer. Yet even as he fired, Corus realized something was wrong. There were no flashes from the pistol's pans.
No upflash of igniting primer, no sparks as chipped flint struck the frizzen. There was only the long, stabbing flashes from the muzzles, more brilliant than ever against the night's darkness as they spewed flame, smoke, and death. And they went right on spewing all three of those things. Impossible, Corus thought as the Sajin fired his fifth shot, then his sixth, his seventh, his eighth. Sandal had been the first to fall. He sat at the top of the stairs, both hands pressing at the blood-gushing wound in his abdomen, head shaking in either disbelief or denial, while his eyes glazed their way into death. Captain Margale screamed in rage as his commander fell and charged the stairs, sword in hand. Behind him, 45 more men hurled themselves towards the single figure in the blackened armor standing at their head. But each time Merlin Athroy squeezed one of those triggers, another man went down, screaming, unconscious or dead, and he went right on firing. Courage that might have brushed aside his fearsome reputation was no match for the drumbeat of death and destruction thundering and flashing from his hands. The cloud of gun smoke was so dense they could scarcely even see him through it, but still he fired, each muzzle blast illuminating the cloud of smoke like Langhorne's Rakurai, and the heavy bullets ploughed through them like the sword of Chihiro himself. As their formation tightened to charge up the steps, some of those bullets tore through two or even three bodies, and Kingsaim's guardsmen broke. They fell back, stampeding into the darkness, and the Inquisitors who had launched them gaped at the demonic apparition at the top of the stairs. Merlin Athroyes had downed 13 Delphirakan guardsmen with 10 shots, and he raised his right hand deliberately. "My regards to Vicar Zaspar, father," he called, even his deep voice sounding something high-pitched and frail after the thunder of so much gunfire. "He'll be along shortly," he added, and an 11th thunderbolt leapt from the pistol. Gijsbert van Dijk was almost 50 yards from the tower stairs, but the heavy, soft-lead bullet struck him squarely in the centre of his chest and punched cleanly through his heart. "And I haven't forgotten you, brother," the Sajin called, and Baldwin Gamelin squealed in sudden terror before the pistol in Merlin's left hand ended his squeal forever. 8. Royal Palace, City of Talkara, and Sarum Mountains, Kingdom of Delphirak. Merlin stood on the front steps, shrouded in a cloud of powder smoke, slowly fraying on the breeze. He surveyed the body-littered courtyard with ice-cold blue eyes and holstered his left-hand pistol, then heard a sound behind him. Human ears battered by that much gunfire would have been unable to hear it, but Merlin Athroy's ears weren't human. He turned towards the soft noise and found himself facing Tobias Raymere. The ex-sergeant's sword was drawn, his face tight, and his eyes were hard. "I'm thinking all those tales about you being a demon or a wizard aren't so far-fetched after all," the sergeant grated. "I can see where that might occur to you," Merlin replied calmly. "On the other hand, there's nothing at all demonic or magic about my pistols, Tobias."
"Oh, aye, I can see that,"
Raymere said caustically.
"Why, just anyone could shoot for an hour or two out of one wee little gun like that."
"No, not for an hour," Merlin corrected in that same calm voice. "Just 6 shots, Tobias. Only 6.
"6?
Raymere glared at him.
"Why not 10? Langhorne, why not 30?
"Because they wouldn't fit into the cylinder," Merlin told him, and Raymere looked down as he heard a metallic clicking sound. His sword never wavered, but his eyes widened as he realized the Sajin's pistols weren't like any other firearm he'd ever heard of. For one thing, they seemed to be made entirely out of steel, except for the wooden hand grips. For another, Some sort of heavy cylinder had just come out of the centre of the thing to rest in the palm of the Sajin's left hand. It left a queer, squared-off gap or opening in the middle of the rest of the weapon, and Merlin held it up where he could see it. "It's actually a simple concept," he said. "A friend of mine, I call him Owl, made it for me. He calls it a revolver, because the central cylinder here," he waved his left hand gently, "revolves when you cock the hammer. If you look, you'll see it has 6 holes drilled in it. Each of those is big enough to hold 1 charge of powder and 1 bullet. The bullets are a bit smaller than the ones most of the guards' pistols fire, but to make up for it, the charge is about 1/4 again as large, so they hit a lot harder. And it doesn't need a priming pan, because a very clever Carizian officer, another friend of mine named Mandrain, invented something called a percussion cap that flashes over when you hit it with a hammer. If you look here." He reversed the cylinder, showing Raymer the back end, which was solid, but had 6 raised, odd-looking bumps of some sort. "You'll see where the caps fit over the nipples here, so the hammer can strike them as they rotate and each shot lines up with the barrel." He shrugged. "It's just a way to carry more firepower, Tobis, and I promise you it violates none of the prescriptions. When we get to Tellisberg, you can discuss it directly with Father Pater, our intendant, if you like." Raymer held out his free hand, and Merlin smiled slightly as he dropped the cylinder into it. The sergeant turned it, held it up to one of the door lanterns in order to see it better, then raised it to his nose and sniffed the scent of burnt gunpowder. He lowered it again, looking down at it for several seconds, then drew a deep breath, lowered his sword, and handed it back over. "I'm sure you know your own business best, Sajin," he said. "But you might want to warn people before you do things like that. Could save yourself a peck of trouble, not to mention a sword in the ribs, now I think about it." "Tobis, you're a good man," Merlin told him, "and if you can get a sword into my ribs, I'll figure I must have deserved it." Raymer looked at him suspiciously, obviously trying to figure out if he'd just been complimented or insulted, and Merlin smiled. Then he looked past the sergeant as Duke Corris appeared behind Raymer. "That was certainly impressive," the Earl said, just a little tartly. "Was it really necessary, though, Sajin Merlin? Once they stop running, they'll spread the tale of your demon weapons all over the kingdom. If they might have had any trouble getting together the manpower to chase us before, they certainly won't now, especially with 2 Inquisitors dead to boot." "Finding the manpower was never going to be a problem, my lord," Merlin replied calmly, reaching into his belt pouch and extracting a cylinder identical to the one in Raymer's hand, except that this one was still loaded and capped. He slipped it into the revolver frame and slid the locking wedge back into place to hold it. Then he holstered the reloaded weapon, drew its twin from the other holster, and replaced its cylinder as well. "The Inquisition can and will rouse the entire countryside," he continued as he worked. "Whether or not I had any demon weapons won't matter a solitary damn as far as that's concerned. But if you'll notice, the entire Royal Guard has temporarily decamped. I figure they'll be back shortly. Whatever else they may be, they aren't cowards, and as soon as they get over the shock, they'll come back. They'll be cautious, but they'll come. In the meantime, however, we can get a bit of a head start, and it's occurred to me that the best horses in the entire Grand Duchy of Talkaira are right here in King Zaim's stables. I realize you have some nice ones waiting for you at that livery stable outside town, but I doubt they're the equal of the ones in the royal stables. Not only that, but depriving our pursuers of horses that good strikes me as an excellent idea as well, and while I'm thinking about things that might discourage or hamper pursuit, I think I'll just take the opportunity, while you and Tobis here go acquire our transportation, to leave a few little incendiary calling cards here and there around the castle. Places like, the magazine, for example." He smiled beatifically and looked at Raymer. "Do try to get them moving, Tobis," he said. "Those guardsmen may come back sooner than I thought, and I'd just as soon be on our way." He swept the stunned-looking Earl a bow and headed down the stairs. Iris Dakin managed not to groan as she swung down out of the saddle. The sun was working its way towards evening overhead, although that was difficult to tell at the moment. The mature-growth forest they were passing through had been only thinly invaded by imported terrestrial species, and even the towering Seyfroldian pines seemed small and dwarfed under the shadows of the Titan oaks. Most of those Titan oaks had probably been growing here since the day of creation itself, she thought. Some of them were as much as 15 feet in diameter at the base, and each individual tree would probably have produced enough wood to build an entire war galleon. Even this early in the spring, they wove a solid green canopy overhead, and the dense shade of their branches had almost completely choked out any underbrush. It was already dim, bordering on outright dark, under that twiggy roof, but at least the absence of undergrowth had allowed the fugitives to make excellent speed. They'd maintained an alternating trot and walk for the last 22 hours, pausing only to rest the horses occasionally, or to swap their saddles to fresh mounts. Merlin had been right about that, she reflected. Not only had King Zaim's stables had the best horses available, but there'd been enough of them to provide each member of their party with no less than 3 mounts apiece. Not all were equally good, but even the worst was well above average, and the spare mounts had allowed Merlin to set a pace they could never have maintained with only a single horse each. And he had. Oh, but he had. Iris was grateful her father had had scant patience with the more scandalized ladies of Mantia, who'd insisted his daughter had to ride side-saddle. She would have been even more grateful if she'd been able to stay in practice after her arrival here in Delphirac. Although, to be fair, she thought she had stayed in practice, until she had spent the better part of an entire day in the saddle. But by her estimate, they'd travelled almost 80 miles, something closer to 60 probably as a wyvern might have flown, and they'd left the foothills of the Sunthorns 3 hours ago, which meant they still had somewhere around another 150 miles again in that mythical straight line to go. "He's a remarkable man, isn't he, Philip?" she asked quietly as the Earl took her reins. The princess loosened her saddle girth and patted the weary horse's neck affectionately, then took the reins of both horses, while Corris performed the same service for his own mount. "I assume you're referring to the redoubtable Sajan Merlin," he said, smiling at her tiredly. He'd done more hard riding than she in the last couple of years, but he was also better than twice her age. "Of course I am." She smiled back and shook her head, then twitched it to indicate the Sajan. "Look at him." Prince Davin sat on an outcrop of rock, looking up at Merlin with an almost worshipful expression. Iris could have counted the number of times she had seen him that relaxed since leaving Coruscant on the fingers of one hand. Yet she knew Davin was only too well aware that somewhere behind them they were being vengefully pursued. It didn't seem to matter to him, though, and she wondered how much of that stemmed from the aura of competence and, well, invincibility that clung to the Sajan. Certainly it would make sense for a terrified little boy to take comfort from the presence of an armsman who was renowned throughout Seyfold as the most deadly bodyguard in the world. And while she wished Davin hadn't had to see the bodies and blood littering the palace courtyard, knowing all that carnage had been wreaked by a single man who was now dedicated to getting him to safety, had to be reassuring. Yet that wasn't the whole story, and she knew it. Unlike her, Davin's instruction in horsemanship had been far from complete when they fled Coruscant, and King's aims had discouraged him from pursuing it in Delphirac. There were times, Iris suspected, the king had been instructed to do exactly that by the Inquisition. It wouldn't have done for the boy to be capable of escaping them, after all. But whatever the reason, Davin definitely wasn't equal to the brutal, bruising pace Merlin had been setting. Fortunately, he hadn't had to be. Merlin had simply taken him up before him on his own saddle, wrapped one arm around him, and told him one fantastic fairy tale after another as they rode along. Iris had never even heard of half or more of the stories the Sajan produced effortlessly, and in between tales she had heard his murmuring voice calmly answering Davin's questions without a hint of patronization. And then there'd been the intervals when she had looked across and seen her brother sleeping peacefully, despite the horse's motion, held safe in the crook of that apparently tireless arm. No wonder Davin looked at him that way. And either Merlin had the homing instincts of a messenger wyvern, or else they were hopelessly lost and he simply wasn't going to admit it. He had never hesitated, never taken a false turn, never stopped and looked for landmarks. It was as if he had some internal sense which knew exactly where he was at every instant and exactly where he needed to go next. And he had an equally uncanny ability to find the easiest, fastest going. Iris had been on hunting expeditions in Coruscant with guides intimately familiar with the area of the hunt, and she'd never seen anyone thread so effortlessly through such difficult terrain. In fact, she was beginning to wonder if there was anything the Sajan couldn't do.
"I agree, he's remarkable, Iris," Corrie said softly, his eyes too on Davin as the Sajan passed him a wedge of cheese and the boy smiled up at him. "And it does my heart good to see him with Davin. But don't forget, he's a Carisian, and his loyalties to Caleb and Charlion." "Oh, I'm not forgetting," she told him, a hint of bleakness shadowing her hazel eyes. "But I don't think he's pretending to be a good man, Philip. Davin's got very good instincts in that regard, and look at how he's opened up to Merlin. And I can't see a man like that offering his sword to a monster, or—" She looked back at Corrus, meeting his gaze levelly. "To someone who'd murder a defeated foe who'd offered to negotiate an honourable surrender." "I agree," Corrus said after a moment. "And I think Caleb and Charlion are probably about as honourable as rulers get. But they're still rulers, Iris. Even the best of them have to be willing to do what's required to protect their subjects and their realms. And Davin's a prize of enormous potential value." "I know, Philip, I know."